Welcome to the Space Cave, a big warg to all of you. Sad to hear about Merle Haggard this week, but rather than dwell on that, go rifle through some country gold, find yourself some, any of it, really. It's fantastic. I grew up with Merle Haggard, got to see him live once when I was a kid. I don't think I really appreciated it, because I was young. He was just playing solo, but I still really enjoyed it. And I'll miss him. So here's a tip of the cap to the Okie from Muskogee, Merle Haggard. Been a rough year on musicians this year. Anyway, you guys, let's get into part two of my chat with the Riverboat Gambler Zone. On the mend, his lungs healing nicely. Here's me chatting once again with Mike Wiebe.
Kind of hear those dogs barking. I think we'll be all right.
You mean to go murder them?
If you could just give them a talking to. Let's start at a talking to.
Break their necks.
Just go commando them. I still don't see why no one's ever done a sketch about an ex-commando who now runs a successful chiropractic office. And the only way to, like...
Oh, yeah, that would be so good.
He gets in there, grabs you like, I can still see it. They're like, oh my God, I feel so much better.
Have you ever been to a chiropractor?
Yeah.
I love it.
It's the best feeling.
That noise. It's not just a feeling, it's that a noise.
Yeah.
With the feeling. You can't...
Especially when your head's laying there real limp, because your ears are so close to where that kind of action is happening that it feels like it's readjusting your whole person. Like, everything about you.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, I'm my whole body is aligned now. My blood's going to be flowing better. I'm different now.
Yeah. Maybe there's something weird about noises that come from your body that aren't your mouth, you know? Because, like, I mean, farts are really funny.
Yeah.
But, like, and then...
Wait, here's my finger.
Yeah. And it's weird, because I guess the other thing about noises that come from within your body, like, it's the rare noise that you hear but also feel, you know? Mm-hmm. Like when your stomach goes blah, 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 and you hear it from inside yourself too.
Yeah.
It's like a weird...
I call those indoor farts. like I remember one time being sort of on a date, and we were watching a movie, and then my stomach just kept like... And then I'd be like, well, we can agree there's no smell, and nothing exited my person. But it was still unsettling. Like, mm-hmm. Okay, we'll just enjoy this.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Because it's not like when you're hungry and your stomach kind of...
Yeah.
It's not that. It's this weird bubbling. Yeah. It's disgusting.
It's so gross.
But when you go to a chiropractor, they tell you like, oh, all that is interconnected. Your digestion, all that stuff. Like it's coming from a place of you're not aligned correctly. Who knows if they're correct, but there is something when
I always question that.
I think people that do a lot of yoga and are very like their breathing is under control and they're not eating outrageous amounts of sugar and, you know, like really rich foods. I think they don't have those things.
No stomach stuff.
But you eat pretty healthy, and you still have them sometimes, right?
Yeah, for sure. I don't eat that healthy. I mean, I
just
eat healthy.
Dismissed my whole damn assertion.
Yeah,
we eliminated that suspect.
Yoga dudes are so weird. Like, I think I would get really into yoga, but the few times I've been to a class, and just the guy's tone was so phony and so like, that's not you. That's a character. You're doing a character, and it's whether you buy into like. It's like going to see a performer or something.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to go see Fish. They can play, I'm sure, but I don't fucking like that song. And I don't just, like, as a performer, I don't like this at all.
Yeah. It's weird that someone like Eddie Vedder continued that level, kind of a story, kind of a rock star, kind of, we just would laugh. Like, oh, okay, that's sure. your whole thing. Like, but it fits into that mystique and that kind of like.
I contend that if Eddie Vedder would have committed suicide instead of Kurt Cobain, we would treat Pearl Jam the way Nirvana is treated exactly. And Eddie Vedder, because they were both the effusive, I don't really like being famous. I can't really, yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, he was, I don't like being famous. And Kurt was more, I don't like being famous. Like they were the same guy. They were mm-hmm. the same tortured guy. Only one of them was more tortured better, you know, like one of them won, you know, like,
yeah,
he,
and, well, tortured by like, yeah, I think like the existential side of it and then like drug addiction and
yeah, but
different paths, but I see what you're
different
saying.
Different paths, but their personality archetypes were exactly the same. What year did Cobain die? 93.
Mm-hmm.
At 93, like, or just go back to like 92, like, other than Eddie had longer hair and it was not blonde, like they were the same, and they were the same dude. At that point,
it would have been the Alice in Chains thing.
Nah, man, I don't know, I'd have to do the research, but I feel like their record sales were pretty close. And Layne Staley died after Kurt Cobain.
So maybe it was a passé at that point?
It was passé.
Just bad timing?
Yeah. It was well after. He'd already put out like a couple bad records too. Because at that point, Pearl Jam had 10 and the
Versus?
Album with the goat on it. Yeah. Uh-huh. And Nirvana had put out, they bleached, but if you talk about mainstream success, Nevermind and In Utero.
In Utero, and then the live thing had just sort of come out.
Oh, and yeah, the live thing. But they were both at like, you know, undoubtedly, Nirvana would have made a not as successful record. You can't just keep making more. There's only so many people that, you know, they're not. At some point.
But he was like a David Bowie disciple, and 30 albums from David Bowie, and they're not all chart toppers.
But within that time period, there's some that are fucking hated, you know? Mm-hmm. And if Bowie, but he'd done enough good stuff that he was always going to be loved.
So don't you think they would have maybe had that as well? I mean, because Pearl Jam, their live shows are like these religious things now.
Yeah.
I think Nirvana would have, say he cleaned his act up and...
No,
and,
I'm just saying, well, but yeah, I'm saying like people would still love Nirvana, but like Kurt Cobain is defined as the voice of Generation X. Like, yeah, there's undoubtedly, he is Generation X.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying if Kurt had lived on and Eddie would have died, Eddie Vedder would be the voice of Generation X. And he would be, you know, and if you just walk down Sunset, you're going to see some kid, like a young kid, a kid who's probably like 23 or 24, with a Nirvana shirt or a shirt with just Kurt Cobain's face on. You're not going to see a shirt, an Eddie Vedder. I mean, they do fine, but you're not going to see a shirt. Like, Pearl Jam is still, like, paying their utility bills through music and stuff.
You know, see around here all the time are kids, and adults as well, but, like, young kids of every different ethnicity with the Nirvana and that sort of happy face with the X's.
Yeah.
And that, like, resonates to still. People just look at that just from a graphic standpoint. I think, you know, that I like that. It's just a good color scheme. It's a cool,
for sure.
It's saying something cool.
But I think you would see those same kids wearing Pearl Jam shirts or just a shirt with Eddie Vedder looking pensive. and Nirvana would still be doing fine. They would still be playing shows. A lot of people would love them. They would be doing great. They probably would have broken up and done solo stuff or whatever. But like, they would occupy, kind of, we were talking about the Myra Breckinridge spot. They there's a definite spot in every generation for the effusive dead rock star, or
well, they
the
had
rock
a
star
lot
who dies
vying that time. There's the Blind Melon guy, Layne Staley, the Sublime guy. Like,
but
all
I
those
think,
people were.
Don't
in,
you think Kurt was first? I think he was before all them.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So,
and his was the most impactful and traumatic, and they were at such a pinnacle.
Huge
but they
peak.
Weren't. They weren't at the peak everyone thinks they were. Nevermind was a huge peak, and then In Utero was kind of like a step down.
That's true.
But they were still at a high level.
Yeah. Definitely, but I, and he was like, maybe it was another thing. He was like the first of Generation X's our age to die, you know, of like the, you know, I'm Generation X and this is my guy, which I don't know. I feel like I'm a year off from Generation X. I can't remember.
I think I'm right in that.
You're right in there.
I think, because I mean, I remember kids in my junior high school. Yeah, high school that were
I can't remember what the numbers are.
Yeah. But yeah, like the 2 days after with the shirt with his face on it.
Yeah.
And me, I felt connected to it and knew the songs, yeah. But it was so, because I wasn't like a music head or, you know, it wasn't something yeah. where like I had a record collection that I would go, I wasn't one of those kids. So it was kind of foreign to me that so many people that I knew that I'd see in school clearly were going home and like listening to CDs and drawing a connection to yeah. bands. So when it mattered to them, I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I didn't realize some of it was posturing. There were definitely some kids. That were like, yeah. Oh, you're wearing the shirt with a face on it. I'm gonna go this weekend to the mall and get mine.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of bands that like. I feel like this is a cool band, and not everyone has this. It was yeah. There's a lot of.
I feel like this was a cold open to an episode of a TV show.
Yeah.
Credit. They just blast right in on who would have been if the roles were reversed. How would it be? And we'll never know, man.
Yeah.
But maybe we'll get to live our lives. The idea of infinity, I've been thinking a lot about lately, in just that, like, we have a finite, fixed version of what we think infinity is. Like, okay, well, we'll live yeah. the life of every animal and everything on Earth, and then we'll move on. Like, what if you live every insect all the way up to every giant charismatic megafauna? Hello.
What is a charismatic megafauna? Is that a redwood?
That is from...
Is that Groot?
One of my first guests on the show, and she was talking about, like, that's like lions and big mammals.
Yeah.
Anyway, we live all those infinite amounts of times over and over and over again, and live every variation of, you know, like when you have a daydream, if you're driving and you suddenly have a thought of like, oh, what if I just went up on the sidewalk and was running from the cops and I ducked down this yeah. back alley, and maybe there's a reality where that happens
yeah.
and you're on a bicycle and or a motorcycle when you're zooming through, and then so you not only would have lived my life a million different times or a billion or however many to run through the simulation to the finite point of every opportunity, like every daydream you have where you hear a snap in the woods and you look over and then you envision that maybe a bear comes. That was a vision from a life that you live.
Oh,
you
yeah.
go do that. So anyway, like that level of infinity where you live every option of a bug's existence, mm-hmm. Every different reptile, and not only just every type of them, every single one of them it has ever been or ever will be on the Earth. In one of those, Kurt Cobain is still living, and you and I are having the same conversation and going, I still think that it was a tragic loss about Eddie, but I think he would have...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That he would have been the same way. I think kids would wear Nirvana shirts more now.
You're off base, man.
No.
We're back with more Iron Maiden. This beautiful London ale, England. It's from England, British.
England, home of the unique blends of Bobek, Goldings, and a Cascade hops, dominate this deep golden ale with a subtle hint of lemon. It does have a subtle hint of lemon.
Yeah, there's a little shade of it in there. So last time we left off, I remember this distinctly, of you talking about the idea of not wanting to care, like that you are going to a party or wherever you're ending up and kind of feeling, God, I hate that I care that those people are here. And maybe a slight part of you going, do they think what I wore is cool? Or just those little things, like would they have hung out with me in high school? Those
yeah.
little things that stick in your mind. And do you need those, not necessarily insecurities, but idiosyncrasies, oddities, just they make you up, but they also make you tick. They've been helpful in artistically creating this sort of catalog of work you've done. If you say did zen yourself to a point where you're like, I get it, would it be beneficial across the board, artistically included, or is there some fear there that like, oh, maybe I need that, maybe that's what I draw from a little bit?
I've thought about that and worried. That's a common thing I think that people with depression or anxiety are like, I really hate being depressed, but will I be a bad artist if I don't have that depression?
Yeah.
And I think, though, that generally, and maybe you are, but if you're happier, you probably get to create a little bit better stuff.
Yeah.
Or if you're happier, maybe you don't need to create, you know, the stuff, and it's not as big a deal if it's not this blind idea of the perfection, the tortured thing. But it is, you know, there's not only the jock stuff, but I'll talk about in therapy about I'm still fighting phantom battles with my parents over things that are no longer at all relevant. Like my relationship is solid with them, and they don't have any.
When you say phantom, this is you driving and having like fake conversations with them to yourself?
It's less fake conversations and more of, I've always had a real bad issue with authority. And because a lot of times when I was growing up, even from like 8 years old, of like, well, why do I have to go to bed now? Like, why does that? And multiple times I was right. Like, because my, you know, there was just some religious stuff that was kind of dogged down on me. And oftentimes I was very correct about like, no, why that, you know, if I say, Mom, I swear, like if I would get in trouble, if I would say, look, I swear I'm going to do the trash. I'm going to take out the trash.
You get in trouble for saying swear?
Yes, because my mom said that is an affront to God. She didn't say affront, but she would say, that's swearing. You don't swear.
Denton, Texas.
No, that's not what that word means. And it was this bug that would crawl into me and I would have to fight. And it just, not just that incident, but it would kind of trickle down to like, you need to go to bed at 8. Like, why do I need to go to bed at 8? Like, that's not, I don't need to go. I can go to bed at 9 o'clock and be up in time for school. And I would fight and it would just trickle down.
You're going to ruin your dinner. Like, come on.
Just trickle down semantics to here. Every single conversation in every way, shape or form, from huge things to the tiniest little things. And I just developed this thing as I have to show you that just because you say something doesn't mean that it's right, and I'm going to do it the opposite way. And a lot of times, sometimes I was correct, but sometimes they were totally right. They were absolutely right, but I would still like fight through it, and it would just make life harder and do it. So now I'm 40 years old. My parents never tell me to do anything, but I'm
they
so...
They don't tell you to eat your vegetables?
She made me. They make me. If I want to get pudding... But I still have a weird thing with authority where if anyone tells me to do something in an authoritative manner, I'm immediately like, I'm going to figure out a way to do that. That's not your way. And it's so bad that it's with myself where I'm like, all right, I got to get up really early tomorrow and because I got to go.
Oh, you think so, tough guy?
And it's, I don't think it in those terms, but it's so ingrained in me that it's this second nature to anything I have to fight myself on. And so I'm fighting phantom battles from when I was 8 years old, and it's not effective. It helped me at some point. It was effective because it helped me create an identity, and I think it helped me create an identity that went on to go like, no, I'm not gonna be like an accountant and get a sensible job. I'm gonna play music, even though I'm not really that good at it. I'm just
defiance
gonna go do it.
Defiance is a pretty common theme running through a lot of entertainment.
Yeah,
people that just went like, I'm not doing that.
Absolutely.
Mostly just because you told me.
For me, a lot of it was because I just don't, it's not how, no, no.
If I were to be a parent, I think that's how I would present that to people. Like, you're going to go to school, they're going to tell you the things that have, I mean, we are a civilization that is culturally evolving, and we have over time figured out the best methods for farming and et cetera, et cetera. By and large, people have found out the safest way to go through life is get yourself an education, get into a job where you can advance, get a house, have some stability and equity and a little bit of a shell that you can fall back, or you know, a nut you can fall back on, and some sort of insurance to that. However, it's going to feel pretty boring at times, and you're going to wish that you'd rattled the cage a little bit. You can do what you want, but I'm just saying, like, these are sort of the... Not to say evidence, but people's findings typically have been, you know, you're going to run into a lot of artists that are scratching their heads at whatever age going, maybe I would have been better
I think that occasionally. But I'm also really happy about a number of things. I think my only regrets really is that I wish I had taken some of that advice and applied it, the practical stuff, and applied it to art. Because there was a level of like, well, I'm going to do art, but
it goes hand in hand. If someone tells you, like, when you do art, here's what you got to market it. You got to get out there and beat it. You go, well, I'm not doing that. Yeah, if that's what you say is the most effective thing, I'm going to keep it this secret that people have to find. Like, good luck with that. Very few things work out that way. Do you feel lucky in that? I feel like there's this pulp of society, and a lot of them being artistic, and many of them succeeding in doing a terrific job because they're just inherently unique people. However, it seems like when you a group of people who dress the same and suddenly start identifying as the same sort of group and the way they look and do their facial hair or their haircuts, and I always feel like they came from the suburbs and they rode down and saw the same sort of houses, and there was this kind of emptiness of feeling like, what's unique about my existence? It's the same as the person next to me. It's the same as the next door neighbor to that person, to that person, to that person. And them kind of seeking it out through art, like people that had different childhoods that you're like, whoa, this guy grew up in a small town in Texas. Not that it's a tiny town, but like with these religious sort of parameters around it, like that's unique. And to this, I think currently it feels like, well, it's been, people have had that. It's a thing we're familiar with. And yet it's still more unique than like, we took out the trash every Wednesday and then there was a PTA meeting and then the homeowners association would come by and we like, duh, duh, duh. Like the suburbs to me in that capacity seems so predictable and kind of bland. And I think of a lot of people who wanted to be artists just going like, I don't know where to draw from. I don't have anything seemingly unique about me.
Yeah. I think a lot of stuff is, there's always like a little bit of like a, something doesn't feel normal and I got to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was, I was adopted and there was a lot, I think I had a lot of, that's my only interesting thing. Like it was pretty standard. Like it was, I was sort of suburban, but the religious thing was there. And then just, there was always like a weird thing in the back of my head of like, why am I not like my brothers who are not adopted? And like mm-hmm. my family was all very similar. And I kind of was like, I'm a little bit different, like, and not a lot, but enough that it like bugged everyone and bugged me. And just kind of, I think that's probably a bit of a springboard of like, yeah, I got to figure this out somehow.
Well, that can be kind of it can go back to just the genetic side.
Yeah.
You know, if you found out that David Bowie was from, or Terry Gilliam, or people like that, that just, man, they're so creative and see the world so different. Like, yeah, from the suburbs, from a very standard place. Yeah. Like, it's just your genetics. It's just how you're made up. What you're exposed to can, like, in the transcendental sort of, it can expose and bring out certain parts of you, but overall, it's just how you're made. Like, it's just, it doesn't matter where you were put, because you became so much more of an anomaly, I guess, within your family structure.
Yeah.
That must be tough to like go, was this because I'm adopted or because I'm genetically different than them? Or
I don't, and when you're young, you don't understand any of it. It's this very confusing sort of thing that you're trying to figure out. Like, no, you're this, in the 70s, the whole thing with adoption on the 70s, like now, I think people that are adopted, it's a lot more like psychologically sound of like, I think they explain it better. And a lot of times the birth mom's somewhat involved and stuff. But now, back then it was just like, no, you're exactly the same. Everything's exactly this. You're fine. Everything is great. And if you ever feel bad about it, stop feeling bad about it. Because there wasn't a lot of like counseling or anything for like adopted kids, but it was this thing for the longest time. I was like, no, that's not bothering me. And it wasn't bothering me. It's kind of like the same phantom battles. It's just like this thing it's not a thought out thing. Like, I'm going to defy my own authority. It's just this thing you've been doing for so long. It's sort of in your DNA. And
I think,
you have to rip it apart a little bit to try and fix it. But I don't know if you ever, I don't think you do ever completely fix it. It's in the structure, as far as like, I got to do something stupid today to like, not something stupid, but I got to defy something to do things my own way. Like, I steal coffee from Whole Foods every time I go in there. Every time I go in
like
there.
Beans, or you get a cup of coffee?
A cup of coffee. And the coffee's set up for free, right? And
this is free, and you're like, I'm stealing it.
Well, it's not set up for free. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. It's set up in the open. I mean, it's in the free. It's in the free world where you can get yourself.
Where they're trusting you to be a...
trusting. And I just have this fucking thing of a 40-year-old guy who can totally afford coffee. I pay for the food that I get. I can probably easily, just as easily sneak out with that. It's not that I'm scared. I just was like, well, it's... I've got to, but I just have this thing of like, I'm not fucking paying for coffee from Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Fuck, you make way too much fucking money, Whole Foods, jack up the prices, trying to pretend like you're healthy. Not that much more fucking healthy anyway. Look at all these fucking yuppies in here. Look at these fucking rich.
Not on my watch. And then you still go shop there and...
Yeah, and still I... Yeah, it's so...
These yuppies. I'll have two of those, please.
It's a dumb... Yeah, it's awful. It's like a dumb phantom battle that I think that I'm like this makes me better than ever. I don't think that. I don't actually think that thought, but there's got to be some, because I don't even think I just fucking take that goddamn coffee.
Every single time.
Every single
They haven't caught
time.
On at all.
Hell no.
You're a pretty good thief at least.
Hey. It's true.
Hey, I steal coffee. Man.
I drink Iron Maiden beer and I steal coffee. Ladies.
Proud of you, buddy.
Ladies.
Find
me on Twitter.
Hit him up at Mike Wiebe, coffee thief.
Yeah.
Preeminent coffee thief of the United States, if not the world.
The coffee bandit. They call me the roasted bandit.
When I worked at Cap City in Austin, answering and calling, cold calling, people don't really know all the time how comedy clubs work. If there's a comedian you haven't heard of, they're trying to give away tickets. And if you go pay for tickets, bless your heart, but you could just as easily like weasel your way into most comedy clubs by being like, we'll buy a lot of drinks. And they'll go, going in there. And so I would call businesses and go, hey, good luck or good news. You want some tickets. And I hate to give this sort of information away. But this is not what I would say on the call. I'm saying
insider
this to people listening.
Insider secrets.
Giving tickets away because they're banking on like, well, if we can't sell tickets, this person isn't a draw. We'll sell a bunch of drinks. So they give free tickets away. And that's why a lot of comedy clubs have a terrible reputation. Cap City not being one of them because they don't do this all the time. If at all, really, anymore. Who knows?
Please book David Huntsberger.
Please go ahead and book me and give away as many free tickets as you would like.
You can put Mike on the show too.
And so you end up with varying degrees of like who showed up. It was like Bob's Redneck Truck World, 20 employees show up and they're drinking their faces off, and the comedian that week is like a low energy, maybe like female comic. And that, not to say that, but like I think Maria Bamford would not like hecklers.
Yeah.
Comparatively to like, hey, I'm Joe, like I'm average guy. Like, he's gonna love a heckler. Joe average guy loves a heckler. So anyway,
and don't try and get free tickets to Maria Bamford. That show's sold out.
That's
guys.
Sold out. But how when I was working there, it would not be.
Yeah.
You'd be like giving tickets away. And anyway, this is way off the point. But when I would call people and they had the power. Hey, how's it going? It's Cap City Comedy Club. Calling to give you some free click. They just hated the tone. They hated the idea that someone was calling. So I just started prank phone calling everyone. I would just call and then I had the, like, not necessarily the power, but like it was, the ball was in my court. Mm-hmm. If they hung up on me because they didn't like, if they had no sense of humor, like, sir, we're not in the mood for that. And they hang out like, well, they wouldn't have liked a comedy show anyway.
Yeah.
But the people that chuckled, then I could be like, hey, I'm just kidding. It's a comedy club. They'd be like, oh my, that you got me. Yes, we'll come. And so that became the most effective way. And I feel like less than being a thief, there's still an element there of like, it's slightly rebellious.
Yeah.
It's just, I can't stand that idea that, here, go stand out there and be a shithead and let people treat you horribly repeatedly. Like, well, I'll do that a few times, but I'm not going to go in every day of my life and just, hey, I'm Bob from CGI Computer Sales. How you doing? Hey, it's Bob, CGI Computer Sales. Listen, how many computer over every day? Like, make something up, be create, do something so that you feel better when you go home. Like, well, I sold a bunch of computers, but I didn't just call a bunch of jerks randomly. What a horrible feeling.
Calling people is, that was my first job, was a telemarketer for cable channels. And it was brutal. I can't believe that anybody would let I was 15 and it was so awful. I can't, and I just remember, like, I don't know how old they were now because I was only 15 and, 18 year olds seemed like grown ups to me at that time. But like, man, I just remember seeing like adults. They were definitely adults and this is like what they were doing for a living, and they were making what I made, which was minimum wage plus commissions that you didn't. But it's weird to see somebody that's actually good at that, that has the, hi, this is Mike, and I'm calling from Time Warner Cable. We've got a wonderful offer for you right now. It's the Encore movie channel, Encore. And it's weird to see people that are actually good at that. I can't, can you imagine getting good at that? Like, it's such a weird thing of like, you know, like slight turns of phrase and tones, and you figure that stuff out with comedy. But what if you were doing that just to sell stuff and you just did it over
I think
and
about
over
that of
over
like
over again.
Mice that get indoctrinated into a cage and just you kind of grabbing the bars and being like, what is this? And sniffing the air. And you look behind you and there's another mouse. Like, here's how the wheel works. I got that figured out pretty quickly. And here's where you get water. They'd be so proud of themselves. You're like, I got this figured out. And when you go in and the person takes off their headset and goes, watch and learn, kid. Hey, how's it going? Like, they can sell stuff and they feel so good about it. And yet you're going, what is this? This is some weird, like, this is all fake. This is a facade. You've learned how to be good at someone else's ideology of what I don't even understand what it is. It's this weird, gross.
So gross.
Ugh, it's the nothing. Grossest. It's nothingness for us. I mean, other people that are doing it, I'm sure, are very happy and like, no, it's part of the economy.
I don't think anyone likes being a telemarketer. I can't imagine anyone liking that job.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a certain breed of salesman. Like, I bought a car recently, and the car salesman was like a Saturday Night Live character of a car salesman. Like,
yeah,
it was
yeah.
so like, wow, you're like a cartoon character almost. Yeah. And it was amazing. So I guess there are those. And it's that weird thing too, that I surround myself, my bubble's kind of small, even though I do meet a lot of people. It's still like, it's mostly Austin, Texas. It's mostly of a certain age. It's bar goers and then the comedians I hang out with and the musicians that I hang out with and my fiance. It's like this kind of small world of types of people. It's a lot of people, but it's this mostly three or four different types of people and mostly an age group. And so it's so easy for me to forget that, like, no, there are 50-year-old white women from Kentucky that have never heard of any bands that I like, that are have all kinds of thoughts in this direction, and people whose only goal in life is to be a great salesman, who have no ambitions of entertainment or
yeah.
and their idea of happiness is swindling a guy and getting like an extra $100 on a Honda Elantra or something like that.
Not a bedazzled clothing.
Yeah, it's weird that my world is so weird and foreign to them, as theirs is.
Doesn't
mine.
That make you want to crawl a little further into it, though?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
That's why I was really excited when I met. I was just hanging out with my fiance's parents, who are.
You've said fiance twice. That's it.
Okay,
you're cut off.
Sorry. It's weird to say. That's what my ex-girlfriend's parents. She's something else now. But like, there's, man.
Your fiance technically is your ex-girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Sorry. Continue.
And just their whole like life. I'm just not around 60-year-olds. How often are you around 60-year-olds in general?
Right. Yeah. Not frequently. I mean, my parents are about that age now.
It's only parent people.
Yeah.
I kind of wish I had more contact with random 60. And that guy, Hugh Barker, who sold me the car, he was probably in his 60s, and that was part of like, wow,
yeah,
your life is just this other thing that I almost can't even fathom, even though I can, because you're not like, you're from Texas, and I know that, and mm-hmm. and you do a job that I understand. It's not like you're an aborigine or something, but like, you must think of his thought, every single thing that he thinks about is just a completely different thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, when he wakes up, his goals for the day are so different, and his like life and what's going to make him happy is this completely different thing from anything that I ever think of, you know? Because I'm like, man, I just really want to work on songs, or today I want to work on this, you know, joke, or like write, but I got to go to work and that's going to kind of suck, but I'm going to do this at my bar job that is, you know, talking to 22-year-olds, but I'm going to get a joke around with this person.
But even these are probably not the thoughts in your head necessarily. Like, they exist, but they're like cyclical daily. Mm-hmm. And so bigger questions like, am I doing enough? Is this where I want to be? Like, those occupy a lot of your space on top of, oh, I got to go here and I got to do this. I think when we envision other people's minds, a lot of times we think of that guy. Hey, I'm Bob. I'm selling cars. Yeah. Getting up and just going like, love to sell cars. Got to sell.
Oh,
but
yeah,
there's probably a part of him daily that's like, am I making my dad proud? Am I living up to the family name? Am I going to die and be Does he have those thoughts, or is it?
I don't know.
What clouds it up otherwise?
And that's what I'm not. I'm not. And I'm completely not going like he talks like this. He's a redneck. He's lesser. I'm just. I know that it's different. And I'm sure probably are some of those, but they're filtered in a radically different way. I'm sure. Mm-hmm. You know. And I wonder what it's like. And I'm so used to being around people whose thoughts are, even if they're not trying to make it in show business, but they're still like, they're like tattooed people who hang out and have fun, and they're a lot of like service industry people, and we all go to shows, and there's just so when I get to be around people like that, or like my ex-girlfriend's dad, who's this Vietnam vet, my dad was not, I'm never around those people. I'm like, wow, I don't even think about what other that yeah. there's just other cultures out there that are right next door to my culture, you know?
Yeah. I always think about in situations like that, like their built-in life philosophy, whether they're aware of it or not. You know, you see a tattooed guy who just seems to not really give a shit in a very nihilistic sort of zen-like way. Almost like they intuitively on a level understand like either this is the one life and neat if I nail it, but it's also not the end of the world if I don't. Or I'm going to live this life a bunch of times, and this time through, taking it easy. I'm taking like a mulligan lap, and I'm just going to like...
I got Taz on my neck.
I got Taz on my neck. Done.
He's fine. He's
nailed. Like life is done at this point. I got it. Or there are the people, and maybe, you know, by us like pursuing things, just by whether we're trying to be successful at them or not, but just by virtue of like, well, I'd like to squirrel away some time and do this. We are not necessarily trying to achieve, but we're pursuing something. And therefore, like, your built-in life philosophy is kind of like, it's important to do this. Like, you got to make the most of it. And I just, for some, all these people you're talking about, like, when you run into them, I'm just fascinated, like, whether they're aware of it or not, what do they think? Like, you know, obviously, you could say, like, well, if they're religious, like, they haven't given a ton of thought to it necessarily, because they have it. They've thought about what they think it is, but beyond outside of that, not a lot.
I really wonder about, especially the non-religious people of like, because I guess partly because I grew up around a lot of religious, square religious people, and I understand that because it's like, this is the thing that you think about because it makes everything sort of seem safe. But yeah, when you see like, man, I don't think Hugh was in a religious, he's not really, I can tell he wasn't like a religious guy.
And it's just,
man, he was...
To see those, like,
Mike, now listen, I'm going to tell you right now, Mike, this is a good automobile. It is a good automobile. Now, just the whole, I love salesmen.
Because what if they're
and
just...
It's the thing I could never do. I can do a lot of characters and do, like, I can do a character on stage, but to just be... Man, it's such a commitment that I don't think I could make to really... David... Listen. I'm going to sell you this thing right now.
You need this.
Now, this Iron Maiden beer, you need this. Now, David, can I get a commitment from you that you're going to buy this Iron Maiden beer? Because we're going to shake hands, and that's going to mean you're going to buy this beer. You got to turn me down. You got to turn Hugh down.
I turn Hugh down just a touch. He sounds like a Buddy Garrity a little bit.
It is. Oh, this dude looked like a fatter Buddy Garrity.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because
I love that actor.
He's good.
He's so good. It's Buddy Garrity.
Yeah, he's real good. I think, I don't know that I'm always rooting for like an Andy Kaufman-esque element, but when you just like to run into that guy, works over, maybe his tie's loose and or he's in a totally different bit of attire and just going like, hey man, you call me at work. That's how I talk.
Yeah.
I got a job to do.
Or he's a Cockney British accent.
Well, I was out there doing your work, wasn't I? I was trying to sell you a car. Set up, I'll get you a drink. And then you're like, dude, you're way different. That guy, I appreciate.
So your fog locks, isn't it? You like them fog locks?
Because, I mean, you on stage are a maniac. You are Taz. People get you tattooed on their neck, man. You are like an embodied. I saw, and I still think about this. I've been to several shows at the Satellite since then when you guys were in town the last time, I think, that you had everyone up. In Los Angeles is a tough thing to do. Not just up, jumping from the front of the stage all the way to the back, excited. I think I told you about it afterward. Like, that's pretty rare. And I'm sure that's an easy thing to write off. Like, nah, come on. But, like, I've seen a pretty decent amount of shows there. And again, since then, I'm very keenly aware of it, of just how nonplussed the general audience is, of just kind of like, all right, I'm here seeing a show. I can say I did it. I can add this to my, like, maybe this goes in a checklist of things that make me interesting. Maybe this is something I genuinely want to do. Maybe I just happen to come with a friend. Whatever got people there,
yeah,
they have done it. To then go and have an experience where you're like, I was at this show and I was jumping up and down by the end. I was screaming things out. The lead singer was climbing around through the rafters. He really brought people to life. Like, that's a character that, and I'm sure they would wonder, like, what's it like to be inside that guy's head? And then here you are, pretty relaxed, you know, like a normal human being. It's got to be so fascinating for them to be like, what is that? What gear do you hit, or what switch is there?
They must. I'm very interesting. You're correct. You're correct, David.
That's all I was getting at.
I am I'm a fascinating man.
But is there a built-in sort of, what I gather from that, if I didn't know anything about you, if I just saw that, I would say, man, that guy understands the fragility of life and understands, like, make the most of it, really live it, enjoy yourself, have fun. And he's not forcing that down people's throats in an evangelical type way. He's living it. He's an embodiment of it. And people are responding to it because it's genuine. It's not a fake, like, hey, I'm trying to brand myself as a fun, love, and energy guy. I really like doing this.
I think there is that in it, and it's true. But I would be lying if there isn't a little bit of learned behavior. It's like comedy of, like,
sure,
I know this, if I say this joke this way, it's funnier, and then I can build on that. And because you know, at that, by the time you'd seen that show, was a couple years ago, but still I've been doing it for a long time, and there are little things of like, all right, this is working now, I can do this, okay, now I'm gonna do this. And I'll still do stuff for the fun of it, if even if nobody's involved, like, yeah, but it's still going to be a different show, like a comedy show. The energy is going to be different. If you might stay all the same words the same and nobody laughs, but if everybody is laughing or laughing at some stuff, and then the subtleties of like, oh, that joke didn't hit as hard as it would, it hit last night,
yeah,
you're moving and altering and changing things. And it's the same, it's literally the same thing with that show where, yeah, where I'm like, there's a lot of it that's just I'm having, and then there's moments of just elation of like, this is going great, what else can I do now? And there's an improv to it and all, but it's,
but you,
it's,
you're like, so when people would say that was stand up like, well, you did that joke two nights ago and it worked fine, and then the night before, and now tonight, maybe during two shows, do you enjoy it? And as a comedian, you're like, I know it must look crazy to you to watch every show, and like, why are you saying essentially the same words the same way? You even turn your shoulders similarly each time. Like, it still feels new each time. And it's not a performance piece where you're like, and now I chuckle this way and move my
head. Yeah.
Like, you're responding very viscerally to, oh, that did make me chuckle a little bit. And I don't like to chuckle when I'm doing my own set. But that, I like the energy or the response from the crowd. And people pick up on that, and it might make them enjoy it more. People watching might go, yeah, but you're, oh, that's all it is a performance. It genuinely seems like when you're doing it that you are enjoying it.
At that show, I definitely was. But there's definitely a moment here and there at other shows that I'm like, I'm not going through the motions, but I'm not as, I remember that show and I remember being really happy. Like, I was legitimately super happy because it was the same thing. It was like, I've had LA shows that were kind of, I was like, people are enjoying this and a bunch of my friends were there and I was just happy. Like, it was definitely like a really good night, but there's shows that like people don't care as much and I still enjoy doing what I'm doing, but it's maybe not as free for the same reasons, you know. It's similar to comedy in that, like, sometimes you're like, well, I'm having a really good time and these people seem really receptive, I think I can go off a little bit and have fun and go a little bit, and then I don't know, maybe there's the occasional show like, fuck it, I'm gonna go completely off and I'm just gonna go on this thing that's coming into my head right now. And so there, with comedy, but I mean, we're gonna play these songs together, but that was, I remember the energy of that night and like, man, there's energy coming from, this sounds so hippie, but like, there's so much energy coming from the room, I can kind of do whatever I want, I'm just gonna, I don't
but
know
it didn't start that way. I remember,
yeah, no, I remember, I know, I remember that too. I remember like just being, I remember being having to work for it. And I remember also, and then you have the same thoughts as a comedy, like, you know what, I think that was, you know, it's real quick because you're doing something very busy, but you're like, I shouldn't open with that song. I shouldn't open with that joke. Okay, that yeah. was good. That was good. They went down a little bit on this song. Okay, this is building. Okay, I see these two songs coming up. This is going good. And then we rarely, because it's really hard to do. It's a lot easier with comedy if you can kind of know, like, okay, this crowd is not really into a blue joke, and I got a blue joke coming up. I'm just going to go ahead and cut that. How do I rearrange that so it still makes sense? Okay, I can do that. It's a lot harder with a band because it's hard to go, like, it's just everybody's focused on their thing to go, like, hey, we're all clear that we're cutting Rattle Me Bones. We're not playing it. No, not next. And then somebody's like, I think we should. And it's like, not, it doesn't fill the flow. But for whatever reason, the rest of that night was kind of tailored to, I remember that whole tour, we had a set that we never got right because we had a whole bunch of new songs. We were like, we want to play all these. And it was finally towards the end of the tour that we're like, yeah, you can't do that too many new songs at once, which is the difference thing of comedy. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, it was too much new. But that show still went really well. And I remember being really, like, towards the end, we stacked it with, like, the old songs that people knew. Mm-hmm. And
well, to reference our fallen brother, Edward James Vedder, in the Pearl Jam 20 documentary, he, like, would go out to venues ahead of the show in different set list every night, but kind of take in the energy, you know, and look and get a layout for the venue, like, who's going to be here, how are they going to respond. I think this set list, and who knows how well that works, but
that's crazy. But I don't know, well, it's not crazy, I have no way of making that apply to anything I do.
Because you get through a set list by the end of a tour, you're like, oh, we're just now getting it, we're like, yeah. we know, yeah. Maybe like when you know you guys have been at it quite a while though, where and your catalog keeps growing, it's got to be hard to reach back, like, oh, how does that song go?
And you still only get, you know, 30 minutes opening, an hour headlining.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I don't want to play more than an hour. Like, I mean, you can headline and demand to play 2 hours, but we're just not that band, and I don't want to watch anybody for more than an hour.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, if you're going to an arena and paying, you know, $100 or something like that, you might be like, I hope they don't just close up shop in an hour or something like that. Just even if it's a band you don't even like that arena, much, you but know?
I don't know. Or if you have enough hits, if you have enough, like, bona fide hits that you can play for 2 hours and not get into too much. I like a few dips into the deep cuts, but if I'm paying that much money, I want to be singing along the whole goddamn time, pretty much, you know. I mean, there's a couple people I would pay a lot of money to see Nick Cave or Tom Waits kind of do anything, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I would be perfectly happy to not know the songs just because I like them a lot and I think it would be a good show, but I don't know. I just, for what we do with the Gamblers, I do kind of think it's like, it doesn't need to be too much longer. And I don't know how long I can handle that physically.
I know, I'm trying to think of you guys playing at like the Hollywood Bowl or something. And it excites me because I could see it happening as you're still young. I know, like, you're going like, oh, I'm 40 in the black balloons, but you're still at a place where, like, 29 years, you'll be the same age David Bowie was.
Yeah.
It's a lot. There's bound to be a significant amount of material should you guys keep at it in that period.
And he's still that young, even, sort of.
Yeah, 69, people are like, oh, damn. That guy had at least another decade before it started getting real shoddy.
That was weird. Because I didn't know he was ever, he looked super young and then he looked like an adult. And that was it. Like, I never, you know, in those last videos, he was looking, you could tell a little bit of skin hanging, but he did not look almost 70 years old.
And that's with a battery of medications and procedures and, you know, he's a little swollen-ish, but overall. And why is that part of it? Tom Waits is kind of on the other side. Or there are people that look terrible, and you're like, it fits him. Like, that's how they should look. I would be weird if he still looked, you know, pristine.
Yeah. I don't think Tom Waits ever looked particularly pristine.
Yeah, he's kind of fits in that. I watched this Bukowski documentary, and he's one of the commentators. Or he's someone that, like, the interview in that. And again, those archetypes, there are those worlds that people kind of fit into, and, like, I would imagine with you guys, like, you have people you've seen on the road for ages and ages, and the community that you become a part of, where you're like, oh yeah, we're all interconnected in this way.
Yeah, it's weird. We'll do these punk rock festivals, and even though we maybe don't have like the real big success of some of those bands, like it's a really small world, and we're just, it's kind of, it's cool. Like at times I'm like, well, you know, maybe I don't have like a lot of money, and I know I still have to do other things for money, but like it's, I am like happy that like, oh, I get to be, these are like peers, and we kind of like talk about this, it's the same world, like they're just operating at a somewhat bigger level, but they still, it's all the same frustrations and
just that existence. And like the car dealer guy, or people that, the images you take in define your life and your memories. Yeah. And people hearing that, like, oh, what's that like for you guys to like load up a tour van, and how do you sleep when you're driving all through the night and you're cramped in there and like sleeping on a friend's couch or floor, or maybe get lucky and get a hotel through the venue, or all that world, you know, driving at night and having interesting conversations with the one or two people who are still awake. And
yeah,
those things are so romantic and so unique to everyone, I would imagine. Like people that really look at that and go, that's so different. It's not my life. Like yeah. I put the kids to bed and I'm asleep at an early time in the evening or night, and that's my life. Like that's what I know. It's different. Like, you know, you and I don't have children, so we can't know what that's like to see a little creature that's genetically similar to you go to sleep and be like, I love you. Like, whoa, I get this.
Yeah.
But that other thing of like, what is that like? You know, you have that, you share that with people. So you have like this sort of key of entry into this room where everyone goes, oh, you're welcome. You know what it's like. You can come in here.
Yeah, it's cool. It's the weird thing of it's, and it was really romantic, and I was really drawn to the idea of it, and then it was kind of a lot different than I thought it would be, but it's still equally as meaningful, you know. And it wasn't, I guess that's with anything romantic, it's always
right,
the idea of it's always a bit more beautiful than it actually is, but there's still something really great. And like, it is weird to take a step back, and you do it for so long, but then you take a step back and go like, wow, not a lot of people get to do this. And it's got to be like that with comedy. That's what, you know, some of the stuff like drew me to comedy was just like, I just like, one of the things, that reasons why I always wanted to do comedy was because I loved that show, this is a little later on, but I love that show Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn, where it was
like, Greg Giraldo was really good on
Giraldo that. And Patrick. But the thing is, like, it was real loose, and it was just like comedians kind of fucking with each other, and they were talking about stuff, but they didn't agree, but you could tell that they were still friends.
Yeah.
And they were like real different, and I was like, man, I kind of want to have conversations with people like that, that like are just kind of funny, but also heavy, and also like maybe not agree, but like we're not, you know, we don't dislike each other, you know,
because
that's what I loved about that was like, and I do really like that still, like having a disagreement with somebody, but it's still super friendly, you know, like, it's so, you know, so much of Facebook and everything is like, you like Hillary, fuck you. I like Bernie, or like, you know, you like Trump, fuck you, or just, I'm still like, yeah, if you like Trump, what the fuck's wrong with you? But still, I do like having discussions with people and completely disagreeing and still being friends with them. I really enjoy that. Like it, and I don't have that a lot with, because most of the band dudes were just like, you're just kind of all on the same page or whatever. And it was a different thing with meeting comics and stuff. Of like,
yeah,
this happens a lot more.
Yeah, we could get way into that, because I think that those two worlds allow a lot of, from wherever you are in the world, if you end up on a tour bus with someone sitting around waiting to go up to an open mic and you start becoming friends with people, by virtue of just what put you there, I think is just being moderately open-minded or like accepting of other people's thoughts and then going, well, here's why you're a goddamn idiot.
Yeah.
And elaborating to that and then going, here's why you're an idiot. And then you kind of laugh at the end and go, we're both moronic. Yeah. And yet it kind of shaves the edges off and it polishes this look of like, it'd be hard for me to maintain a level of bigotry towards differently gendered people or people of a different sexual persuasion or race or ethnicity or age or etc. You just kind of go like, oh, we're all just these like very confused creatures wandering around on two legs, wondering like, how can it feel good and how can it be nice to be here? And the idea that a church would like excommunicate someone or these things that are just so antithetical to what they, that's what they preach, like forgiveness and love. And yet they would go, we didn't like what you said. And so much so that like, we're done here. That nothing was ever grosser to me, because I feel like any of my friends could come to me and genuinely, like in One Headed Beast, I talked about like people, you know, being like pedophiles or things like that. Like, could your friend honestly come to you and be like, dude, I've been looking at some weird stuff. I think the majority of the population would be like, I'm calling the police. I hate you. You're disgusting. Your initial feeling probably should be that way. But when you look at your friend and go, what is that? What's going on there? Why? Why would you do this? Like, I think that comedians and musicians and people generally of an artistic nature wouldn't condone it at all.
Yeah.
And certainly wouldn't go like, come on, you got to live your life. But they would certainly be the first ones to go like, I'm pissed, I'm mad at you, and I'm disappointed, but what's going on in your brain? What's giving you these ideas that you should be looking at whatever? I mean, that's a hard
thing. I know what you're saying in the sense of it makes you open to also realizing like, well, I'm a little bit fucked up, and that's why I do this. I think most, you know, at least good artists are like, there's a weird thing in me, and that's why I'm doing this. And you can see there, but for the grace of God go I, like if a couple other things had happened to me and I was just a little bit weirder, it could go real bad. I'm not saying that you would, well, I don't know, like people don't just wake up, maybe some of them do, but for the most part, like, or even if they do wake up, it's like, well, I've got a faulty thing in my brain. If it's nature, not nurture, I've got a faulty thing in my brain that needs the acceptance of strangers that I don't necessarily want to get to know on a personal level. Like, it's not enough for my friend to tell me that I'm good. I need a whole group of people that I don't really know to tell me I'm good. It's not that far of a stretch to go like, well, there's a faulty thing that's like, I need, the only way I feel good is if somebody screams at me in fear. And that's why I need to show them my dick and run off. You know, it just makes me feel good. Like, I feel like I've got, or I mean.
But that's the thing that your friend could say to you.
If
you say, what's going on here? Why? They'd say, you know how you love to perform in front of a crowd? Well, I have this weird shit. That would immediately, to you, go, shit, it sucks that that's your thing.
Yeah.
But let's talk through this, because you're, figure out this how to is fix wrong. This.
Yeah. And I, you know, I worked in the psychology. I have a bachelor's in psychology. So it is this weird thing when it's
that's
almost.
How I've promoted this episode.
Oh. It's weird to. It sucks sometimes when a monster or something that you really don't like gets humanized.
Mm-hmm.
Like, kind of back with the jocks, like it's kind of easier to go like, fuck you, jock, you've got a perfect life.
Yeah.
And
you thought this all out and you chose to be this piece of shit. How dare you?
And you walk around with this cut body and women love you and you're just fucking good at stuff without even trying. But then it turns out like, well, you know, his dad was kind of a total dick to him, and his mom died really early, and he's got this weird thing that he has to, and it's just never, he never quite feels good enough. And the thing is, you know, he kind of learned from an early age, if he's not dominant over everything, because then he's a failure, because his dad was so dominant over him. So it's this kind of deficiency in his life that he has to do this. And yeah, women do like him, but there's still a thing, and it's like, oh, no, he's not a human.
Right.
He's not, no, I don't want him to be a human. And it goes all the way up to, like, you know, I mean, you still don't condone, like, well, I don't want to be friends. I mean, I'm not going to be friends with, like, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer or something like that if he's still alive.
Oh, he's no longer living. Oh, okay.
If he's still alive.
I get what you're saying. Yeah.
But there's still, like, oh, this is an op. But there's still a level when you read about his growing up and his problems. It's a sad story. Like, it's a sad from that. And it doesn't make it any better.
His neighbor across the hall, that older black lady that was like, she called him Jeff.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't believe Jeff did this.
Yeah.
There's something so sincere and endearing about that. Like, oh, man, she had no idea. She's got to be more hurt than anybody.
Yeah, that's got to be so odd to have that go on right next door.
Yeah. And then she, like, the documentary, she's like, he served me a sandwich one time. Yeah.
What kind of meat was that?
Yeah. Ugh. All right, man. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've got a lot more to get to, so hopefully next time you're in town, we'll do more of this. Always super fun chat. Yeah, you and I have had a lot of late night conversations of this nature. So it's nice to finally record it, which is really what counts.
Exactly. So now we can prove that it happened, and it'll make us more famous, which will validate that hole that's inside us.
Then we're getting somewhere.
We're getting somewhere.
Then it makes the whole damn thing worthwhile.
Yeah.
All right, Mike. Well, it's a pleasure, sir. This Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden beer's not going to drink itself.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, I hope you enjoyed it. We'll get Mike in the space cave again when he's back on tour, all healed up, and his lungs are able to carry a tune. I don't think I have anything to promote. Thank you to, I think Andy Thompson bought these beers again. So thanks again for these beers, Andy, because we drank the same, the Iron Maiden beers. So, and they're good. If you haven't tried Trooper, give it a shot. It's not just a novelty. It's pretty tasty. So yeah, thanks again to Andy. Thanks to anybody and everybody who has donated so far. I appreciate it. I'll send you some stickers or something like that if you'd like a reward. You know all the ways you can promote the show and share it and subscribe and all that, and find all my stuff at davidhuntsberger.com. But let's get out of here. This is a song when I think of the space cave and just a little bit of escapism, getting out into somewhere in space. This is a song I think of by Merle Haggard that I think everybody in that Thoreau kind of a way, leading lives of quiet desperation. This is putting a voice to that. About just wanting to get out and see some wide open spaces. I played it a lot as I was driving through Montana, or as we were driving through Montana in October on our big tour/road trip. Anyway, this is Big City by Merle Haggard. Rest in peace, good buddy. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.
Big city, turn me loose and set me free.